The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing.
We have main engine start. 4, 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston. Broadcasting to 7 continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to our Monday Space Show program. I am your host, David Livingston. Great to be here. Thank you for tuning us in. Let me run through the announcements and start our program. And also do take note that we're doing an absolutely hard cutoff on time at 3:30 p.m. California time, because our guest has plans and I also have plans. So if you are intending to ask questions or to give us a call on the toll-free number, you need to plan ahead and not wait for the 11th hour because it won't go anyplace. So with that said, our toll-free number is 1-866-687-7223. No call screeners. Do let it ring until it can be answered, and we'll bring you up on air as quickly as possible. About the call waiting problem that we have been fighting AT&T about for the past 3 weeks, in talking with them today, they claim they are removing it, but it may take up to 24 hours. So I'm assuming if you're going to call the phone today, you're listening to the show, right? That's a typical assumption. If you hear we have a guest on the toll-free line, a listener, wait until that person gets off the toll-free line so that we can call, because the call waiting comes to me, and it's really disruptive. So that's why I'm complaining so much about it. So please, and until this matter is resolved by AT&T, if you hear someone using our toll-free line, just wait until they hang up and then call in. Otherwise, it'll just ring and ring and ring, and it sends this really annoying tone to me, and it's very disruptive. So again, the number is 1-866-687-7223. And then also you can do email, of course, Dr. Space at thespaceshow.com. And do remember that that is our website, thespaceshow.com. So there we have a comprehensive newsletter, and it's uploaded Sunday evening. It has all of the details of the week's programming, guest bios, and it's the only place where we have a future events section for the Space Show. So do check it out, and to stay current in case we have to make an announcement and change things, check that website newsletter from time to time. Everything we do is archived and on our website going back to 2001. You can easily download the programs or listen right off of our site. There is a Space Show store. You'll see it up near the top. It's called Space Show Gear. This is the holiday period, so do please check it out. There might be some items that you or your friends or family members are interested in, and we hope so, and your feedback on the store is certainly welcome. There's a guest search tool. You'll see it on our main website page. And here you can do a global search like you would any Word, PDF, or Excel document for your favorite space word, term, or guest. You'll get the dates for that term, guest, or word. And then you can pull those programs up by date with the Space Show website search engine at the bottom of our homepage. If you have any questions on that, do let me know. And then the most important button, Support the Space Show, is there. Remember, we're in our annual end-of-the-year financial campaign for funding the Space Show, and we are a 501c3 nonprofit with GiantLeapFoundation.org. We exist because many of you do support us. We're very appreciative of your support, and we thank you for it. Remember, if you're a U.S. taxpayer, you're still getting a deduction from the federal government, and the same is true if you are a California taxpayer. I'm not sure if there's reciprocity on this in your own state, so please do check if that is an issue of concern to you. We podcast with Andrew at gigadial.net. You'll find the RSS URL on our website, both of our newsletters. If you have any podcasting questions, let me know. And then we are trademarked and copyrighted, but we do give everybody permission to download the programs and to share and circulate them. Please don't do anything commercial. Don't do any edits, private YouTube channel cuts, private website cuts, anything like that. Nor do we permit written transcripts, even if they're for your own personal use. We do not have that permission from our guests to do that. And so please do respect our wishes on these very few constraints for space show programs. If you do have an idea for a space show program and something you'd like to do with it, please email me and let's see if we can work it out. Do remember that we are brought to you in part by the Secure World Foundation, and they promote cooperative solutions for space security. For more information, you can visit their great website, www.swfound.org. Remember, they are the sponsors of our webinar series. Well, I'm happy to bring back to the space show our friend Mark Bray, who is over at Marshall Space Flight Center as a contractor in Huntsville. Mark supports the SLS program, though we're not really talking about that today. He has 18 years of broad experience in manned spaceflight programs at NASA, including design, development, manufacturing, and operations. His education and training is in aerospace systems, and his expertise is in materials development and supplier qualification certification for space transportation systems. His bio is on the website, so you can read it, and we don't have to read about him. We can start talking to him. But he is here today to discuss development of a commercial space market, applications of the Geoffrey Moore's Crossing the Chasm space policy, and the challenges of transitioning the aerospace industry to a commercial industry. Mark, welcome back to the Space Show. A very Merry Christmas and Happy New Year to you and your family.
Same to you, David, and thank you for having me.
Start us out, and Geoffrey Moore's Crossing the Chasm is about a 12-year-old book now, 15-year-old book.
Yes.
Still a bestseller in business school. How are you applying this to commercial space? And maybe you should start at the beginning and give a brief summary of what the theory is behind Geoffrey Moore's work.
Yes. So Geoffrey Moore looked at the innovation curve, and what he did was he broke up the different groups of adopters of technology, and he specifically was focusing on, in his book, focusing on high technology, high-tech markets, and high-tech companies, and the way in which you take a product and move it into the mainstream, and that is the predominant place in which where the big money, the big profit, if you will, is made. And, of course, in modern terms, a perfect example of that would be Apple, you know, with the iPod, iPad, and its products was when Steve Jobs returned, they had a core market in the 10% of the marketplaces and educators, and they were enthusiastic about Macs, and they used them all the time, and they were a very devoted customer base. But Steve Jobs recognized that for Apple to succeed and grow, it had to move into a place where the mainstream, and what Geoffrey Moore calls the first 2.5% of that curve, of that big bell curve, is the innovators. And then the second group, which is about 13%, is what they call early adopters. And there's a gap between those two, but it's small. Then the next 34%, and then the next section after that, are what he calls the majority. So there's the early majority and the late majority. He calls the gap between the early adopters and the early majority, in terms of a marketplace, as the chasm. And he says most high-tech companies fail because they get into that, they're able to market to the innovators and the early adopters, but when it comes to trying to make that leap over the chasm into this early majority and really start getting the benefits of economies of scale and so forth, they most of the time fail miserably and fall into this great big chasm, and companies are either, you know, go bankrupt or they get bought up or so forth. So his advice, and you know, some of the recoil since then, is that too many high-tech companies are now focused on the early majority in this big marketplace, and they fail to do the right thing in the beginning and capture the innovators and the early adopters. And there's some truth to that as well. But Geoffrey Moore's biggest point is, if all you ever do is capture 10% of the marketplace, then you never move into the real realm of high profit. But to do that, you have to recognize they're completely different markets. What the consumer in the early majority and late majority want are very different from what the consumer and the innovators and early adopters want. Well, so from that perspective, I started, you know, about a year ago, started really asking the question as to what is the market for, quote, space? And I'll even take it a little bit broader. You know, all these spin-offs we hear about from NASA and, you know, going to the moon and going to having the space shuttle and all these other high-tech developments that have come out of it. You know, what really is that product? What has NASA done for the country? And I think that's an interesting question because if we don't identify what that is and what space and space access really is and the technology side of things, then we may be missing the point as to what it means to be commercial space. And I think that revealed a whole another world in terms of the discussion of what should we be doing in this commercial space market and what is it that the industry should rally around in terms of growing this pie into something that's good for everyone in this industry as opposed to fighting over the shrinking government dollar.
What should we be doing as compared to what we are doing as we work to develop an emerging commercial space industry?
Well, I know I'm going to get some, and you're going to get some on my behalf, some probably some angry emails over this statement. But
par for the course.
Yeah. So, you know, it really, when you know, going back to the Steve Jobs example, when he came back to Apple, he said, "You guys make a great product, and you love your product, and you understand it, and oh yeah, there's this devoted marketplace over here that will continually buy our product. However, they're not going to be capable of sustaining the growth that we need, and we will continue to lose money." And so, you know, if you take that model, we think, well, space is different, right? But I actually think there's a very valid lesson there, is that in the aerospace world, we tend to be focusing on what it is in our industry that we want, and then we ask the question, can we go sell that out in the broader market? Is there a market for that outside of our industry? And right now, we seem to be focused on, gosh, we want to send people to space. We want to send people to the moon. We want to send people to Mars. And so is there a market for people wanting to go to space? And the answer is no, there isn't. That doesn't mean there's not a market for space. And if we would do what Apple had to do, which is ask what the customer wanted, I mean, you know, Apple had, way back in the day, they had the Newton. It was a good concept, but it wasn't really what the market wanted. But it was the basis by which the iPod and now the iPad and so forth have, you know, come to fruition, is that it was the beginning. And then it had to, you know, Apple had to ask the question, what does the market really want, and how can we provide that? Let's go make that product, and we'll cash in on it. The space industry as a whole, and as far as I can tell, most of the major suppliers are not asking what the market needs are. They're asking, how can we sell the things that we already make? So if NASA has paid for human space access, how do we go sell human space access to other markets?
Well, what are the products of human space access that are marketable to people?
Well, okay, so meaning what kinds of things do we have that could be spun off?
Well, I concur with you that space cadets think that what we talk about among ourselves and what we want is what needs to happen, and then the world out there will come marching to our door for it, i.e. space tourism, for example. And the verdict is out on that, and there will be some people that do it, but is it a huge sustaining market? We simply don't know. Suborbital science, you know, citizen science is another one. There seems to be a lot of early interest in it, but does it transform to a sustainable market that also can grow and eventually over time become a mature market? We're saying to ourselves, yes, but that may not be what the world out there really gives a hoot about. What I'm asking you is, and I really don't know the answer, so I'm looking for you to tell me the answer, of all that we do in space other than from communications, because there we know what the product is, what is the product that we're producing or that we can produce that is marketable to people other than, within our own community?
Right. Okay, so that's a great question, and it actually has two different answers. The first one is that when we think about the things that we've had to do in order to make space access attainable, technologically attainable, we have developed new materials and new capabilities and new test methods that don't exist yet out in the private sector, but they have applications. So, for example, the Twin Towers, the 9/11 attack, and some of the analysis that went into how those buildings collapsed, and some of the ablative, fire retardant systems and so forth that were in the building, proved to be insufficient. You could argue, was that because, you didn't design it to have an airplane run into it? I don't want to get into that debate. But the point was is that there were some materials that have been developed since those buildings were designed and constructed that actually they were developed for space vehicles, but now they do have application in a variety of industries, including the commercial, high skyscraper construction business, where a lot of those materials can be put into place that would facilitate or prevent, major fire destruction, if you will. That has been done in the past. Those materials and the developed processes for those, they have attempted marketing those in the past. But what's interesting is that some of those companies that had those capabilities that were developed for the shuttle, for example, for reusable booster systems, those companies don't exist anymore, or the company that had that capability, that intellectual property, passed it on to NASA and is really not interested in the liability side of it. So you ask the question, is that something that could be marketed? Well, right now, nobody inside the space industry is really thinking along those lines. What are these? Because we the taxpayer, expect that NASA is spinning those things off. But the reality is NASA is not a marketing machine. It doesn't exist. It's not in its charter to go find other technological uses for things that it has paid for the development of. Even if it wanted to give it away, some company out there has to make use of that and market it to another industry. And as far as I can tell, that's not happening at all.
Okay.
So that's the first part. So what is it? Even if we never find a large market for going to space, there are things in which we do that make space technologically achievable that could have significant money-making spin-offs into the private sector without necessarily handing it over, but leveraging it and putting a business case and a business model together. The second part of it is, I'm not sure. I concur with what you said. The jury's still out, but I'm pretty convinced myself that from the market research I have done on my own time, NASA's not paid me to do this, but the market research that I have been doing to understand what the real needs of a market are for going to space outside of communications, I don't see any interest really in going to space in any sustainable way. There just aren't enough people with enough resources to sustain the kind of travel frequency that we would need to begin even bringing down the cost to something on the order of $1 million a seat. And $1 million a seat is not trivial, but we would have to be flying 1,000 to 5,000 people per year on a fleet of 4 or 5 reusable vehicles to get to the place where we could even bring the cost down to that level. And I just don't see a market out there large enough to sustain that.
Now, you're talking orbital tourism, correct?
Yeah, orbital tourism. Yeah, exactly. Even if there was a market to do some sort of human-based manufacturing in space, if you could get to that place, I don't see the cost of it being sustainable to a developing market, such that the commercial sector, who may be interested in some of the science going on, they're not going to be able to invest or willing to invest with their shareholder money. You know, we're talking numbers on the orders of a couple hundred to almost $1 billion to some sort of meaningful access, long-term access to space, you know, something like what Bigelow's offering, but in a human platform on the commercial side. I just don't see any meaningful market that has the capacity and is aware of their need, and that's the big part, right? Apple realized that there were a lot of people out there who could benefit from their product, but they didn't even know that they needed the product. You know, I was one of the late adopters in that scenario. I got a BlackBerry about 7 years after everyone else, and I just switched to an iPhone this year. Now I couldn't imagine living without it. That's the marketing side of this, is creating something and making the outside market, who isn't even aware that they need what you have, aware of that need and then willing to invest in it. And I just don't see human tourism or human space, human access, human presence as being a driving industry. An analogy to that in history is we didn't go out to California. You know, the westward expansion of the U.S. wasn't driven by people wanting to see the Pacific. It was driven by the discovery of valuable resources, and train tracks were laid in order to get those resources in as efficient a means as possible at the time back to the East Coast.
Well, what about valuable resources in space and ventures like planetary resources or lunar in-situ development and things like that?
Well, again, I think those are... That is, in my opinion, that's an appropriate place. Going to the innovation or technology adoption curve from Jeffrey Moore, see, that's where NASA is. NASA is the innovator. You know, they if you wanted to, quote, sell your product to an innovator, NASA is the ideal target market for that high-tech. They're willing, according to Jeffrey Moore, this group is willing to let you fail. They're willing to spend money on it for the sake of discovery and developing something new, and you make mistakes along the way. That's where you should be marketing those things to, because that's cutting edge. We've never done it. We need to learn as we go, and that's where NASA resources could be applied. The real question here, though, is not, is that something that's marketable? I don't see a whole lot of other innovators willing to spend that kind of money, but NASA is an appropriate place for that. But I'm talking about the rest of that curve, the early majority and the late majority, and the known capability we have to go to low Earth orbit. Is there anything useful in that regime such that a commercial market could benefit from? And the answer is yes, I just don't believe it's humans. What technology is there, and I'm going to backtrack a little bit and set this conversation for where I think we are. When man transitioned from the Stone Age to the Bronze Age, it was the discovery of manipulation of materials in various levels that enabled the formation of alloys. That discovery fundamentally changed human civilization for the rest of history, because it enabled agricultural growth and, you know, settling in and planning and all those other things that had to be developed out of it. There is real science that has come out of the International Space Station and other civil servants, you know, who are close to retiring, who have done some research, that says that microgravity manipulation of materials, and you can take that word materials and expand it to any meaning you want, biomedical materials, pharmaceutical materials, alloy generation, so forth. There's real science out there that suggests that, and needs to be demonstrated and proven, but it says that these materials, when processed in various ways in a microgravity environment, they fundamentally behave different and yield different properties and different capabilities that we cannot achieve here on Earth in a gravity environment. That discovery and that advancement has broad application in every industry. And a commercial company interested, and I'll give you an example, outside of our industry, right? So if the space industry goes and markets to a different sector of business out there who has no knowledge of space, and they can be explained the benefit of microgravity to their product, their process, and why they want to be the move themselves into the innovator curve of this and pay for the development, that market there could be the genesis of an explosion in space access. Go ask what those companies need. They don't need a $100 million mission on an unmanned capsule or a very expensive, long bureaucratic process to the space station. They need something that they can drop $20 million on tomorrow, have it fly and come back with meaningful data over long duration. I'm not talking suborbital short-duration flight, but long-duration orbital flight, you know, 30 to 360 days, but unmanned, completely automated, get the material and the data back, and be able to react to it in the next budget year. That's what business needs. And right now, the supply chain on the aerospace side doesn't seem interested in meeting those needs. There are some that are finally starting to show up, but they have, you know, they have left other large companies to go start their own companies or work for a small company to develop this capability. So being somewhat the visionary here, David, I see that 2014, 2015, 2016, if things stay as they are, we're going to see some significant, sustainable, not an explosion, but significant, sustainable growth in the small rocket launcher category with some really cool, innovative use of CubeSats and even some smaller automated labs that are going to provide some meaningful R&D for commercial sector companies. That's where I see the short term, you know, next 3 to 5 years going.
Okay.
And if the industry wants to meet that market need, I think there's a lot of money to be made there. But I'd also point out to you, I think it was you had Charles Cooley several times on the air, but there was a guest you had a few weeks back that really intrigued me, that he was thinking the same payload size and launch capability that I believe the market actually is looking for.
Let me interrupt you just for a minute.
Sure.
Number one, we got an email I'm going to read. But listeners, for those of you that can multitask, and if you do not know how to multitask, ignore this message. But the first of the Grail probes is about to whack the moon. And if you think that you can see it and you want to try to see it, go to space.com. And click on the Grail, see it live, and turn your sound off because I don't want to hear it. And you need to hear what we're talking about. But in the background, in theory, you'll be able to see what happens on the lunar surface with ebb and flow. And the lady who is the PI of the Grail mission, who is on and off on this video, is our Hotel Mars John Batchelor guest Wednesday night to talk about ebb and flow and the Grail mission. She's the PI and she's over at MIT, but for today she's down in Los Angeles in Pasadena at JPL. So you can see them, they're all standing around waiting to see it whack the surface of the moon, and maybe they'll get to see a little dust or something come up. I've got the sound muted, and thanks to Charles Pooley, by the way, who pointed this out and gave me the space.com link. Listener Michael Listener, how about that? Listener Michael Listener, pretty cool, huh?
Yeah.
Your guest makes a good point, meaning you, Mark. In the airline industry, aircraft manufacturers look to the airlines, their market, before investing in developing a new aircraft or a new aircraft variant, and this applies to something you said earlier in the show. I'm just now getting around to reading his email. Well, they're clapping, so it must have whacked the surface of the moon, although I didn't see anything, and now they're all walking around like they've done God's work. So I guess they know for a fact that the first one hit, and more coming. So is there anything marketable from science missions such as this, Mark? I mean, our robotic science part of NASA is to die for, in my opinion. It is so spectacular. It is just, it's unbelievable. It would seem to me that there should be, at least theoretical, Mark, that there's got to be stuff coming out of what can be done so amazingly on the science side that has commercial market potential.
Without a doubt, David, and I think that, you know, goes back to what I was.
By the way, for anyone looking at the video, that's the lady right now, and I forget her name, Dr. Zucker or something like that, who's the PI of Grail, and she's going to be on Bachelor with me and with Bachelor Wednesday night on our Hotel Mars. She's talking right now, but again, I have the sound muted. I mean, this is the most incredible asset this country has, is NASA science missions.
No, you're exactly right. And I guess where I wanted to go is that guys, I've been to Congress. I've talked to, a third of the congressmen and senators up there with regard to NASA. And I can tell you unequivocally, if there's one, I'd be surprised. But the majority of Congress, and forget the average person out there in civilization, but the regular, average congressperson has no idea what NASA does. They think NASA is a pure science and research place. They think NASA makes rockets. They think there's a lot of things that they think.
Well, and
NASA
they think
does.
The budget is 50% of the whole government budget. I mean, they have no idea that all of this is half of 1%.
Exactly. And so, and quite frankly, David, we can't explain it to them. It's a waste of energy to try. And it's certainly, I think, just the marketing challenge of trying to educate 300 million taxpayers, why they should invest in NASA. But the point I think I'm about to make is that if we, the space industry, and I'm talking to the new space guys as well and the old space guys, right, if we can explain what NASA really does within our own industry and help it to focus on that. That is its relevant part of this transitionary time that we're going through. NASA is the innovator. It has the ability to fund things and fund projects and do exploratory research and robotics that I don't think any commercial industry or market would want to pay for. But the things that come out of that absolutely should be transitioning to commercial application as private industry and the companies partnered with NASA find those markets to serve. And so the answer is yes. And if you look at what NASA does, David, I mean, really at its core, it has its hands in everything. It has its hands on the very raw science side. It has it on the payload integration side, the development of CubeSats, the rocket propulsion technology, all the way to guys like me. And what I do is, in my day job, is I facilitate materials manufacturers' development and qualification for new materials. So when we need a performance out of something and that material doesn't exist anywhere on the commercial market, we have to go out and figure out, well, what is it we really need and what kind of companies make something close enough to it, and then prescribe how we get them to a place to make something on a regular basis. And we are developing raw materials manufacturing, feeding into component design. NASA does all of that, and at its core, what it really does, and I'm not saying it does it well, but at its core, what it does is it relates and translates all of that information from top to bottom. So the question is, if NASA could state that as its goal, could then metrics and all of the management structure be centered around doing exactly that and executing it really well? And I think it could. But since you have Congress who doesn't know what NASA does, writing the laws telling NASA what it should do, it seems unfathomable to me that in the near term we're going to be able to, because there are people inside NASA that would love to do some of the things that the new space and commercial space and all the citizens and space cadets want. Believe me, they want that too. NASA employees and managers want to be just as relevant and the right part of this equation. They want to see commercial succeed. They want to see expansion into commercial markets and a growing pie. They want to see that, but it's not their job to make it happen. And so, if transitioning real quick for you, David, I want to discuss the NRC report and the different options there, but one of the options was partnering and collaborating and NASA taking on certain roles because that's the core function it should serve, but figuring out how to enable the industry to do all of these other things that have to be done. It just doesn't necessarily have to be NASA to do it.
You got a phone call and an email. Which do you want first?
Well, I guess let's go phone call.
Hold on. Hi, caller. Welcome to the show. How are you and who are you?
This is Charles Foley, hoping you get your phone issues resolved.
Well, it is out of my control, Charles.
Okay.
I am in the hands of AT&T.
Right. Yeah, for me, it rang only twice and you answered. That must mean that no one else was trying at the same time. So
No, well, you're listening to the show, so you know no one's on the line.
Well, yeah, the show's delayed, so I don't know.
No, it's not delayed that much. Come on.
I thought it was, never mind, 2 minutes or so. Anyway, touching on what he is talking about at the time I made the call, yes, NASA is a good source of, or method of innovation, and it is doing many good things, particularly, most famously, with unmanned explorations. The lunar probe crashing now is being deliberately crashed because it served its lifetime. It's done. And that is justifiable. But what is missing is what we could call now DIY space, do-it-yourself space exploration, is missing. And with micro launchers, I've been pushing the idea of trying to create a design or a method that is so small and so inexpensive so that thousands of spacecraft can be launched, not to orbit, but to space between Earth and Mars initially, and to allow, to be cheap enough to allow thousands of people to be directly involved in operating a space mission. And this is totally missing. This is like, well, in the days, in the computer days before the advent of the microcomputer, you know, the mainframe era. The only people who get their hands on a computer was to people who got a job managing one. And then in the 70s, something happened.
Are you on a weird kind of phone line? There's some kind of noise coming from your phone that we've never heard before.
Really?
Yeah.
Other than my voice? I'm on a landline, and it normally behaves very well.
I think there's electrical interference on the line. It's really bad.
I am hearing a faint 60-cycle buzz, but it's very faint.
Yeah, well, for us, it's louder than your voice. But oh, but that's what we're hearing, too, is a 60. Well, I don't know if it's 60-cycle, but it probably is.
Yeah, it's a familiar hum thing. I am hearing. I'm going to turn this. Nope, I just turned a fluorescent light off, and it didn't change.
Nope, I don't know what it is.
Okay, well...
Mark, do you have any thoughts on do-it-yourself space and what Charles is talking about?
Well, I guess to pay the highest of compliments to Charles in the concept, I do think that that's actually, from my point of view, that's visionary. We will be there. But, you know, to use your analogy of the mainframe, it took a long time for saturation and use, and in fact, the transition was large mainframe computers you know, being used. And even though the vision in the 1970s was to maximize use of microcomputers or you know, home PCs, if you will, the market transition that you're talking about, it actually happened first with businesses. The federal government was involved in purchasing and using you know, personal computers or desktop computers. And then through the 80s, the transition happened through the school system. You know, lots of schools were budgeted to start using microcomputers. Even, I think I had a microcomputer in the 1980s in school before my dad had one at work in terms of a dedicated, you know, machine. And then in the 90s, it became rapid expansion to the consumer market. So what I would suggest is that we're going from really big rockets that have scaled up in order to put maximum stuff in space, and one day we will be in a do-it-yourself space mode. But in the in-between time, I think the more successful market is not in, it's in leveraging the technology that's already been developed for industrial use and application in other industries. And then in the long run, we were going to see even more micro-launchers.
In your recital about computer growth, you missed an important thing, and that was the birth of tiny, affordable computers in the mid-70s. And the same equivalent thing I've been proposing for space exploration, the birth of affordable small, very tiny scale exploration, which does not now exist at all, and it would create a presently non-existing culture of people who can directly involve themselves in exploring space.
Well, I keep saying to you all the time, Charles, there's nothing stopping that segment from starting. I mean, the people who are in it are committed to it.
So what's stopping it, or not yet happening, is that there's overall a kind of a mentality that has people thinking about space in terms of end result without developing the means to get there.
Well, not among the people who articulate and support the message you're talking about. You do, what you talk about has its own school of followers. And what I'm saying is that that school, that segment of the market, there's nothing, there are no barriers to entry for them unless the people who are following it and who want to do it are morons without any money. And then, there are barriers to entry then.
I'm not a moron, but I don't have any money.
No, I'm just saying there really are no barriers to entry other than one's capability and one's financial ability to attract capital.
Or seeing and getting the idea. The mid-70s, MITS and Altair and those things didn't happen until they were ready to happen, and then they happened at some time, mid-70s. Was the appearance of critical components like the Altair, the Intel for future, and things like that. And it could be that that's what's timing it, but also it could be that there's an overall cultural belief that space exploration is the province only of large collectivist governments.
But I really don't think that that is applicable to the market that you're talking about, because I'm seeing things done with CubeSats, and I just got the list of class projects for Dr. Thangalebu's.
CubeSats aren't going anywhere because there's no launch means for them.
Well, but there are launch means for the CubeSats, but I'm also seeing launcher plans and things. I'm telling you that the people who subscribe to all of this are actively working to develop their ideas. Now, I don't know that they're going to be able to develop their ideas, or that they will find that there's a market, or that they have a capability of taking it to the level of being sustainable with markets. Mark may know more about that than I do, but I honestly don't believe that this segment of the market is handicapped by the general perceptions of the space industry. The people who want to do this are moving forward and doing it on their own or with their own groups or subgroups, and they're finding a way to make it happen.
Well, okay, it simply hasn't happened yet. It should happen soon.
Well, we're going to see.
All right.
I hope it happens. Mark, anything else on this call?
No, I guess I will close, I guess, with one comment, and I said, you know, if there's some good marketing data out there that suggests that that this is sustainable, I haven't seen it yet. I haven't dredged it up yet. I haven't, the market data I'm coming to, when I say market data, I'm matching the companies and or individual consumer who have resources to pay for whatever it is they want. I'm not talking about changing what the market wants or telling them about something that they don't know about. I'm trying to divine, if you will, what it is they want versus the costs that need to be expended to achieve it. And I just don't see that particular segment as showing up as a large enough segment to drive an investment in the capability.
Yeah, that gets into a whole different, unrelated problem, the venture capital barriers and so on. But I'm talking about trying to create not so much a rocket, but a new culture of people that can do hands-on direct involvement, and that can be done by making a spacecraft system so small, so inexpensive, that there can be thousands of them, each at a very, very low cost, measured in thousands of dollars each.
Remains to be seen.
Yeah, remains to be seen. I've been working on it. See what happens.
Okay. Thanks,
and
Charles.
And I've got till the 21st to get it done.
Why? What happens? Because of...
I just thought I had to leave you that.
You probably do believe the end of the world is coming, so call in on the 21st. We have a show that day. And
oh, they're going to also. I saw on Spacecom that they're going to cover that live.
Cover what live?
You know, the website you cited, Spacecom, to watch this lunar thing.
Space.com. Yeah, but what are they going to cover live? The end of the world?
Yeah, it says.
The asteroids
probably
coming.
Tongue in cheek.
God.
All right,
I don't get it.
Thank
you, Charles.
Right.
You have an email. Let's move on. From Doug in Southern California. Question one, is the SpaceX Dragon Lab something like what you're talking about, Mark? Number two question, a number of people advocate that NASA should revert to the NACA, N-A-C-A model. Do you hold this view?
Oh, those are two good questions. The best thing I can say for the first one is that I am under the auspices of an NDA with SpaceX. I can't speak to Dragon Lab. The second one, I don't necessarily hold the view that that's where they should be. And it's kind of like, you know, you and I have spoken in the past. I believe that that is a role. They could be defined as that role. They could be defined as purely a regulatory agency. But that's not the real question. It's what the final end state is what everyone loves to argue about as to what we ought to be doing. What is missing in every discussion about where NASA ought to be is how do we go from where they are today to where they ought to be. And so, in other words, if there really is a commercial market, and NASA and the federal government own a great deal of resources and assets, what is the plan by which we're going to transition those assets and those resources and those capability over some period of time? Because we are talking about human beings, and transitioning somebody who's been, you know, doing something for 40 years, or, you know, or 20 years, 30 years, and is looking forward to some sort of retirement. These are all real decisions and real issues that have to be addressed. And you don't achieve the goal by just saying, pass a law tomorrow and say NASA shall be like NACA again, and you guys just get to go figure it out. There's a whole lot of questions that have to go along with that transition. And what I would say to the emailer today is that it doesn't really matter what I think they should do or shouldn't do. I think that's where they're going to end up. It's going to, in a decade's time, that's where they're going to end up being. There's still some hope, I guess, from some that SLS and large spacecraft exploration, human exploration, is something that NASA can achieve. I'm hopeful that that will happen. I'm not so sure that the realistic side of me says that they can. The challenges that they face with Congress and the budget and all kinds of misperceptions about what it is they do, and this very debate that we're having about what they ought to do by people who care, puts them in a very bad position to be able to do anything effectively. And you know, not to defend NASA too much, but a lot of this is not of their doing. The good people that work inside NASA didn't ask to be the football that they are. They, you know, believe NASA was valuable and they love their country and they wanted to be a part of something amazing, you know, that humankind has never done before. So, but I think that's where they're going to be. And the real question is, what are we doing from now to then? And, you know, to put the finest point I can on it, as long as things stay the way they are, and you know nothing major changes in the next couple of years, I think that the industry is figuring it out. Right? There's a major debate during Constellation. There's a major debate to protect it. A major debate to have SLS, and there's still some debate going on. But this election basically said we're going to have the status quo at least for two more years, probably for four, and that gives some stability to knowing where things are going now. So companies that started two or three years ago trying to figure out, you know, what they're going to do in this next model, they know that they don't have to put down their plans and start over again because we have a different president. So they're going to keep going with those plans. And I'm actually pretty optimistic that by 2015, 2016, we're going to see some real significant steady growth and a few profitable missions that time will tell if I'm right or not, but I think it's going to drive some profitability to other industries, and it's going to start leveraging the value that all of us space cadets think exists in space access travel. I think those values are going to be leveraged to other industries. And when the people paying the bill actually see the tangible benefit from what they're paying for, you have a real good commercial model to grow from, and that is how the U.S. is going to lead the way, if ever again.
All right, we're going to take our break because we're a little over the halfway point, and we need a break, and we're going to end on time as we talked about. So listeners, stay where you are. We'll be back in about 2 minutes today with Mark Bray and more of your questions. Don't go anywhere.
The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with the Space Show. Your support of the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support the Space Show button. Your contribution will help the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to the Space Show is tax deductible.
I'm Dr. David Livingston, creator and host of the Space Show, and I would like to share my vision with you for not only this radio program, but for space development. Space should be like any other place we choose to visit, work in, or call our home. It should be just another destination, like Tahiti, Hawaii, or any place available to us right now on Earth. When this vision becomes reality, we will be spacefaring in our culture, our economy, our society, and in our lives. Our world will be vastly improved by countless space-related benefits, transforming our lives both in space and right here on Earth. And the Space Show is helping to make this vision a global reality. And welcome back, everybody. We're into part two of our Monday afternoon Space Show program. Our guest is Mark Bray. Mark, an email came in before we went on our break from our friend Todd in San Diego. And he says, Mark, are you factoring in the U.S. economic crisis, the proverbial cliff we keep hearing about, and the global economic situation? What makes you think there will be continued space investment or private sector investment over the next 3, 4, 5 years, or maybe longer, given to what is going on? And I might add, Mark, just before the show started, I read to you where the U.S. has increased its foreign debt 75% in the last 4 years to over $5 trillion, more so than ever before in our history. So our debt and our economic crisis is probably not sustainable. It looks like they're going to remove all caps on the debt ceiling, at least for a year, and we know that when that comes up, they'll kick it down the road for another year. Following Todd's suggestion, how do you factor in what's happening economically in the country and globally to what we're talking about today?
Well, okay. A couple of good key points there, and I'm certainly a realist, so I recognize the strains that's put out there. However, if we're talking about, I'll just give you an example. If you're talking about alloy material manipulation and drawing of fibers in a microgravity environment where you get material waste, but processing here, maybe this particular product has 75% waste, and if you can do it in an economical fashion, for less than $10 million, and some of the prices we're looking at are talking about targeting less than $5 million, for companies that have R&D budgets the size of, $150 million a year, to spend $20 million, $10 million, or $5 million in a year's time to do some research, the economic conditions of this country and the globe hasn't yet put them in a place where they've stopped spending money on R&D. They're just being very smart about what they're spending their R&D budgets on. So the question is, do we have something valuable to their bottom line that it would interest them in spending the money? So the business, you know, a company looks at a potential customer, a large or small company, looking at this sort of use of space, isn't going to make a decision not to do it because of the fiscal cliff or anything else. Otherwise, they would have already stopped spending that money today, and they haven't done that. So they're still looking for ways. Now, that pressure, the cost pressure, inflation pressure, and so forth, is actually a motivator. There are some companies that I've spoken with that if they see this as a leading-edge technology to invest in that could give them a decade ahead advancement, or in the business-to-business world, it puts them in a place at the head of their competitors where they have the better chance of surviving during major economic downturns, then they're going to take it. So, and that's the point, right? We got to ask what the customer wants, what the business leverage is that they want, and go meet that need, as opposed to getting them to buy the stuff that we want to sell. So that's the first answer. Now, the second answer, I see something a little bit more optimistic. I think the debt and some of those things, fiscal cliffs, are certainly problematic for development of any private sector commercial industry. However, there is one piece of good news that the media seems to not want to share very much, and that is the fact that we could be the largest exporter of oil or producer of world's oil, by the end of this decade, and oil energy independent by the end of the next decade.
Well, this assumes the government allows it to be used.
Well, right. No, you're absolutely right. So, Ken, it's not the fiscal cliff and some of the debt issues. To me, it's the regulatory issues. We have regulatory issues within the space industry in terms of the FAA and what can launch and what can't launch, what kind of missions, what kind of satellites. We have regulatory issues with our energy supply chain, our food supply chain, and our water supply chain. If we are going to continue down a path where the government continues to overregulate and stifle that innovative expansion and meeting those needs, then our economics will only get worse. However, the upside of this, and this is now, I guess, somewhat of an appeal to some sanity in Washington, is if we allow this to go on and we allow our country to be independent, many of the costs that we sustain right now protecting resources that we buy from all over the world to sustain our lifestyle, we can drop those costs. And if we have economic prosperity, by definition, some of the social welfare costs that we have in our country should go down because we have a lot of people, the ones who are willing to work and put forth effort and think and innovate, they're going to be prosperous. And so I see a potential for the next decade driving a whole different world view of what could happen. And the real question is, will our government allow it to happen, or will it get in the way of it happening? And that's outside the picture of space and NASA. But certainly the environment of the political environment of a country can stifle or enhance or grow innovation.
Well, I'm definitely reading more and more in the financial and the business stuff that I follow and read, which is mostly credible. I don't just glue on to this blogger or that blogger because, who knows if most of the blogging is really credible or not. But, they're pointing to the regulatory cliff that we're facing as being potentially more destructive than the fiscal cliff that we're facing.
Yeah.
So I don't know which way the U.S. will turn. I have my hunch, but I've been wrong before, and I hope I'm wrong this time. But I agree, we have an enormous potential to turn this around without as much pain and suffering for our people if we will only take and seize the opportunity.
Yeah. So so direct to the answer the email. Certainly there are ways in which our government could put more things in the way. to stifle it. I'm not really sure what their motivation would be.
Here's another one that just came in from Jackson in Las Vegas. He says, David, I'm at work, so you're getting an email. I can't use the phone. But ask your guest what it will take for space to be properly appreciated and valued so that the issues that your guest is talking about and the others are talking about can be made in the beneficial way to help space and the country. Right now, I don't think space is valued or appreciated by Congress. And I think the real issue here is how do we change the image or the perception of the value of space so that what we in the space community know space is all about, but we don't seem to be able to translate it to those outside our community very well.
Wow. He said a lot, and I would concur with just about all of it. So the question, how? What will it take is the first profitable mission. Okay. What's interesting is that you go back to communication satellites, which we spawned here, and then you look at the supply chain, and a lot of people say, oh, they ran away, if you will. That market ran away from the U.S. space industry because it was just cheaper to fly elsewhere. And the answer is that's not necessarily true. Total cost was actually only, if you include insurance costs and risk and all those other costs that are rolled into the real cost of going to orbit with communication satellites, they were only marginally cheaper than the U.S. The real issue that drove communication satellites away was that commercial launchers couldn't ramp up to meet the demand, and because of range and other issues within the government regulatory system, the communication satellite launch providers couldn't meet the market need. And what's interesting is you see the countries that they fled to, they had a strategy or a goal, USSR, Soviet Union, Russia, so forth. They had a goal of just building a space access infrastructure and then letting whoever wanted to come ride on it, come ride on it. And that served them well. When we have a U.S., it doesn't have to be U.S., but when we have a fully commercial launch vehicle with a fully commercial payload with a real profit margin, then I think it fundamentally changes our industry.
Well, wait a minute. When a telecommunications company launches on an Atlas V or a Delta IV, why isn't that a fully commercial vehicle with a fully commercial payload?
Truth be told, costs are subsidized. So
who's subsidizing the telecommunications launch when they're the payload?
Well, for example, the cost accounting system, and that you make a good point, but the cost accounting system of the Atlas V is that it is owned by the DOD, right?
No, because when I do shows with ULA, they say it's a totally privately owned commercial launch company. Now, I'm not in a position to refute them or to jump on the bandwagon and support them. I simply don't know. I do know that EELV was built with a lot of private money plus Air Force money. It was subsidized just as Falcon 9 is being subsidized.
Right. And the cost of soaring, we in the space industry know about all of the assets that were built up during the 2000s that end up not being utilized, right? Who subsidized the storage of those assets? And those are the costs that we're talking about. So when you start talking about why isn't that a fully profitable, private mission, it is and it isn't. And that's the real difficulty right here, is that we don't really have the exact model that some have been trying to use in the airline business, where we have government-funded but essentially commercially operated airports. We don't have that model yet in a fully realizable sense on the space side. La Cruz is, New Mexico is building a spaceport, and they're doing some things, and the question at hand is, are they really going to be allowed to go the full tilt with the FAA, and can that be a fully viable commercial launch site to orbit and beyond, you know, those are some real questions to be asked, but they're not there yet. And that, the question is the mission repeatable? Is it profitable? And does it have a potential growing market, you know, for growing the launch rate as opposed to it's a five mission count to learn something and then we're done?
Well, then what you just said, many would argue fits the Falcon 9 and the Falcon Heavy to a T, because they claim, you know, it is a growing commercial market for it. You can look at their manifest. So does Falcon 9 meet your smell test, so to speak?
The criticism I would have of Falcon 9 is that it was still funded and is funded by the commercial crew work and the development work. And I would argue, again, I have an NDA with SpaceX for some things, so I'm not speaking about the things I know on that side. I'm speaking about the guy sitting on the outside looking in. You can't possibly, having done this for a while, you can't possibly know your costs yet. You're still in the development phase. How many Falcon 9s have we launched? We haven't launched the Falcon 9 Heavy. And to know what your real costs are so that you can start talking about that larger market, that's something only SpaceX will know once they do it. They have to do it for, you know, several years, get their real known costs down, watch their costs drop if they're really running the efficient model and, you know, and they can start hitting launch dates and so forth on a regular basis. They can't have a failure, you know, that they had in the past mission.
I mean, well, so how many launches do they have to launch in order to have reliable information on cost?
Well,
or any rocket for that matter, not necessarily SpaceX.
Just take SpaceX out of the equation. Go back to the shuttle days. Our real known cost for operating the shuttle was intended to be driven after several, I think it was the first five or first seven shuttle missions. And that's why the design and development contract ended in 84 and was transitioned to an operations contract, because by then they should know what the real cost for regular, you know, run-of-the-mill everyday mission and turnaround is. And I would think that SpaceX or any other rocket maker of that size, they have had how many years of development costs rolled in. And they have to capitalize those costs into a revenue stream. That has to be driving their prices at some point. And the question is, do they have enough of a market to get them through? Does that rocket maker have enough of a market to get them through capitalizing all those costs, realizing the revenues, and paying back that investment? And then from there, being able to drive, you know, much higher profit margins. And that's what I mean. Is SpaceX profitable today? And the answer is no.
Except he says, Elon says they're profitable today.
Well, they're not a publicly traded company, so I can't validate balance sheets or anything like that. But my guess is the amount of money invested to keep the company going, to hire the talent, to build the rockets, has not yet been made back. I doubt they've made back their total investment in revenue stream yet. The dollars just aren't there. Even if they charge $200 million per Falcon 9 launch, they haven't made enough money back to pay all of the money they've had to pay in.
No, probably not, but they could be profitable on operations only.
Well, and understand, I'm not saying it's a viable, it's not
on cash flow
business model.
Right.
I mean, how long did it take for Amazon to finally make money and Google to finally make money? And those certainly didn't have the high capital intensive costs of making rockets.
A long time it took Amazon to.
Right.
And look at how many markets they now serve and how many gobbled up operations they have under their umbrella.
Yeah, I mean, you know, to use my definition, I know I'm being pretty harsh on the business side, but I think, you know, you and I would agree on the, you know, the smell test is, you know, GM isn't profitable anymore. You know, when does GM become profitable? Well, when it pays back all of the money that it took from, you know, the taxpayer, and the government owns zero stock in it and has no interest in its productive capability. And I would argue SpaceX, so long as it is essentially passing on development costs and capabilities through the commercial crew contract, even though it's a Space Act agreement and it's not a FAR and all those other things, it's still able to subsidize some of its costs through a government revenue streams. And from my purist point of view, once it's not really commercial until it doesn't need subsidization at all. So that means that NASA would only pay for it at the time in which it's delivered for that particular mission, and no other contract long-term is required. That's a hard model to get to for these big things with people in them. It just is.
Okay. By the way, I'm keeping track here. We have about 15 minutes.
Okay.
Before you need to take off. And listeners, if you want to call us and talk to Mark, it is 1-866-687-7223. Let's look at where we are today, at the end of 2012. And, boy, you know, half my shows have a key word, commercial space. Okay. And half the guests I have on talk about the developing and the emerging commercial space market, and they think it is really, really different, except the reality is all of our companies in the space world are commercial private sector companies, because we don't have any nationalized industry in the United States other than GM, and I don't know if there's anything other than GM, but there is no government ownership of any of our space companies, but there's a lot of government as the only customer and government as the only driver for a lot of what our aerospace companies do. So where do we stand, you know, now at the end of 2012 for developing a fully commercial space industry in Canada, include human spaceflight?
Well, in the short term, you know, here we are, like I said, 2012. In the short term, I would say it can include human space flight, but I don't think it can be fully sustained in the commercial sense of the word. I think that, first of all, you got $150 billion asset in the ISS, and right now it's shared ownership within, you know, with different governments who want to have access to it, so they're going to need rides. I do think there's some market for tourism. It's a premium dollar. I just don't think it's enough to cross the chasm. You know, going back to the beginning of the conversation, I don't think there's enough there. The cost and everything can be sustained, standards developed, in order to really leap over that chasm anytime soon. So what could happen in the next 4 years is we could start to see, and I believe we will start to see, small launchers of the size of, you know, 500 pounds to low Earth orbit to, you know, something on the order of, you know, maybe the cap on that would be 4,000 pounds, but something in the small class range, completely unmanned, not necessarily communication satellites. CubeSats is a very viable market, and perhaps some microgravity labs of various sizes. You know, the challenge there is the microgravity customers aren't looking for something the size of a Dragon Lab. They're looking for something the size of, you know, 100 to 1,000 pounds max to low Earth orbit. So it becomes an integration nightmare to try to align many customers. And, in fact, you saw that with the Google Lunar X, you know, team, is that one of the teams was trying to, you know, buy a Falcon 9 or ride on a Falcon 9 and then get other people to ride along with them to defray the cost. And they had a challenge doing the same thing.
By the way,
partnering rides and lining them all up is not a small feat, and I don't think that we're going to be able to get there. So could we do it? Yes. I think there's a defined market out there. I think it knows what it needs, and the real question is, will the space supply chain meet those needs, turn it into profit, and then grow from there, or will it hold on to, and you know, and I'd argue that the large companies out there with a lot of capital investment in what they have today, the product that they have on the line today, are going to find it's very difficult to be flexible and nimble to go meet the market needs. So there's a huge, wide open opening there for other companies to form or jump into the small launcher business. And I think if that happens, trying to give some advice to some folks out there who might want to be in the business of making rockets. If that happens, I think that we can meet market needs, and we will have a growing, thriving, even manned, human, regular basis I mean, when you start to get to the point where it's not research anymore and one or two things turn into production, say by the next decade it's production, what's your justification for having humans visit these productions? You know, Bigelow could not get in the business of necessarily making hotels, but they could get in the business of making production sites, you know, in microgravity environment, and they're going to need regular visits from humans. That's the model I see. I don't see a whole lot of people building space homes in orbit or space homes on the moon anytime soon.
You have a caller, just to let you know, because I know we're coming up short on time. Hi, caller. Who are you, please?
Hi, David. It's Mike.
Hi, Mike. Welcome back to the show. How you doing?
Good, good. Just a quick point, because I'm running out of time, but I don't care who's launching, whether it's ULA, whether it's SpaceX, or whether it's strictly a government launch. It's not going to be 100% commercial because the insurance is always going to be indemnified by the government. If the government doesn't pick up a certain portion of the liability for a launch, the insurance price is just going to skyrocket, and that's going to make things a lot less practical for launch. So, I mean, when we talk about being pure commercial, going to catch a lot of flack for this, but there's no such animal because the government is going to be there subsidizing, at least in the insurance arena.
Mark, any comment on that?
Oh, yeah. In fact, you and I spoke about it a year ago, that some of the issues that the industry, the commercial industry, has is addressing the liability. And there's a very simple answers to how the industry, a commercial industry, addresses those liabilities. And two of them I've spoken about frequently, and that's standards and certification of professional personnel. The caller is absolutely right. As long as we have states and the federal government covering the liability costs and insurance costs, then what we really have is, we'll cover you. You guys can go off and make money, but when things get really bad and something, you know, bad catastrophe happens, then, that's okay. The government will step in and pay the bill. I agree. That's not really a commercial market. What I'm suggesting is, while we're doing this transition phase and some of this other real market shows up, the industry also has to establish things like standards and educational, certification criteria for personnel, specifically engineers. And why is that important? Because those costs have to be known. They have to be realized and they have to be brought down. The easiest way to bring down liability and risk is by increasing your economies of scale, meeting the market needs, establishing standards so that you have repeatable, reliable performance. There isn't a new, brand-new technology that's going to jump out and make things better for us. We've simply got to meet market needs and grow it so that we can do this on a regular basis.
By the way, listeners, Michael, the caller, has a liability article regarding space debris, but it has broader ramifications, and it's in this week's Space Review. So if you're a subscriber to Space Review, you can pull that article down, and if you're not a subscriber, you should be. It's a powerful free newsletter that comes out every Monday, and it is, in my opinion, a must for everybody interested in the space subject. Mike, anything else you have for Mark?
No, just that quick point, and thanks for the mention on the article. I appreciate
Excellent
it.
Article. Keep me posted on what happens.
Okay.
Thanks a lot. I get a lot of the new space folks who absolutely are convinced that all of this is commercial space right now. So, if one of them would have called in, they'd probably be challenging you, not on the degree of how much commercial we have versus government subsidy, but because these companies have skin in the game, they're commercial to begin with, and it's not a matter of degree. I wish, that somebody from that perspective had called in, because it would have been a really good question for you to respond to, much better than my trying to be a translator here and tell you what that point of view is. How would you respond to that? I'm sure you've heard it before.
Well, yeah, I guess the answer is that so long as the launch site, production supply lines and so forth. I mean, it's the argument then is that GM is still a privately held commercial company, even when the government owns some percentage of
it. Well, but the government doesn't own SpaceX, Mark.
No, the government doesn't own SpaceX, but the government is subsidizing the revenue stream. And you could argue that they're getting some value from that, but the fact of the matter is there's a reason why SpaceX and others, rightfully, in my opinion. See, this is the real point, I think, David, is that when you go after NASA as a customer, they are on the leading edge of that adoption curve. They are innovators. They are willing to allow for mistakes. They're very forgiving on schedule. They're very forgiving on a little bit of cost, except when Congress gets involved and, you know, gets really mad at them for doing
right.
it. They can have accidents and missed missions and things like that, and NASA is willing to do that because they see the bigger picture and they are innovators by culture. The issue that I'm suggesting is that when you rely on them as your first one, and that is the taxpayer money, you aren't really commercial until you get to the place where you are selling your services more to commercial and the revenue and the profitability from that, and then you just look at the government and say, well, we don't really need you anymore. Then you're really commercial. And it's happened in the material supply chain, by the way, for the space industry for the last 30 years. Numerous companies were started by NASA to develop or make a specific specialized material. That material and that production line was sold to a larger company, and that larger company then morphed it, used that technology, sold it off in mass to other industries, and then came back and said, NASA, we need you to buy this, you know, the stuff we're making 98% of now because we have a lot of money in it and we're making tons of profit in the commercial side. We need you to start buying this because, one, it's cheaper for us and all of our assets support it. And NASA would tell them, no, we can't because it would cost too much for us to qualify that. So we need you to keep that specialized old formula set aside over here with these assets. And my point being, that's a business that was started by purely government money and transitioned to private and then fully became profitable on the commercial side and then said, you know what, we really don't need your business anymore, NASA. And SpaceX isn't there yet. Boeing isn't there on the space side. ULA certainly isn't there. You know, when they get to the point where they have so many customers that they can tell the government, we don't need you, and the reality is that, you know, all of the press says that SpaceX is looking for DOD missions.
So what about the suborbital section, because Virgin and X-Corps, they're not getting government money.
No, and that's true. So the argument there is, are they commercial? Yes. Are they commercial low Earth orbit? No.
No, they're suborbital.
Right. And then the question becomes, is their market sustainable for long-term profitability? And so, those are companies, I don't know their P&L sheets either. With the money that's been invested in them, have they broken even yet?
Well, we don't know. They're all private.
Exactly. So that's where it's hard for me to judge, are we really commercial or not? I don't know. My suspicion is based on running rough numbers that the amount of money that they've invested versus what they've gained from the market is that they have not yet made back their investment. I would be very surprised if they had. That's not to say they won't ever. It's just that they haven't yet.
But they don't have government support unless some of these science missions that they want to fly are NASA missions, for example, or DOD missions. But then government is a customer for them and not paying to help build their vehicles.
And completely agree. If that's the only role of the government, I would still define that as commercial too. If it is a reliable or is it a valuable product for any government agency to spend money on, and they're simply buying the ride and the mission, if you will, I would still define that as a commercial model. I'm still getting to the place where are they really profitable and making money and investment. And like I said, I'm not suggesting they won't ever. I'm suggesting that they haven't yet, and they may not for another 5 to 10 years really be declared a profitable company. And when that happens, I'll celebrate. Until then, we still have this looming question over where does American space sit right now, and it's still at risk.
You're 2 minutes out from your bewitching self-imposed deadline here.
Okay.
How do you want to bring us to a summary and close us up?
Well, I think what I want to do is, you know, one of the emails that I, in the very beginning of the program that you read, had a very good point, and I don't know that I addressed it really well, but it just dawned on me to go back to it, and that is, how do we inside the space industry get to a place where we make ourselves valuable and relevant to everyone else? And I would argue that it's not through PR, it's not through Congress, it's not through a bunch of educational campaigns. It is through finding that commercial market that is long-term profitable, that enables a growing expanse. And people today know, when they carry around their iPhones and they, you know, whether we want to admit that or not, they know intuitively how much investment in technology went into that. They may not be able to describe it for you in gross detail, but they do know that it was driving commercial market forces and great innovation and huge leaps that was able to put that into their pocket and have computers in our households. So space will be relevant and valuable when, you know, new lines of communication, new capabilities for various materials and so forth are all showing up in new products on the consumer line, and they go, this was made possible because of this type of innovation and technology, and they know when they're spending that $150 on it, whatever it is that it goes for in the marketplace, they go, this is latest cutting-edge stuff, and it was made available because mankind went into space and found something valuable to do there. That's how we make the transition. It isn't through PR and marketing. It isn't through government expense. It's through finding the real valuable things that human beings and companies want to pay for.
In 10 years, you give it?
I give it 10 years for real, innovative moving forward. And even on the commercial side, we're still looking at the innovators and early adopters to try to educate them on what they could do with what we've already done so far. You know, one final point, David, I'm not that critical about where we've been for the last 50 years. I used to lament, you know, 10 years ago, why haven't we been to Mars yet? And the reality is just like TV, just like aerospace, or airplanes, just like the automobile, space and commercial space and the market use of space required many things to happen. And one could argue that we had to go through the IT boom and computer and technology and all of that stuff first, before we could get to a place where we could really leverage the value of going to microgravity and other things that we may find useful in space. So it's good that we've done all this stuff in the past. We've proven technology and capable. But for it to be really profitable, I think we need an entire resource supply chain across multiple industries and customers across multiple industries to really leverage profitability and value. And I think that's where we're going.
Okay. Any news over there in Huntsville real quick? Anything changing in the labor markets? Is the mood improving from the last time you gave us a Huntsville report?
Well, I would say if improving means there's another derivative, right? So it's that it's not getting worse. So I think for the most part, at least for the next couple of years, people feel pretty stable. There is some growth. Obviously, the fiscal cliff is not something that anybody here in Huntsville is excited about, it's in a negative fashion. But I think for the most part, the work that's in front of us, we feel pretty good about for the next 2 to 4 years. SLS is moving forward. It's got some key milestones. PDR just happened, you know, preliminary design review for the core stage just happened this month. It's going to happen for the booster side sometime in February, I believe. So, you know, from that perspective, the labor market here is at least feeling stable. I wouldn't say that there's a great deal of excitement. This election, I actually did help provide some of that stability with respect to we don't expect an administrator change. We don't expect vast changes in the scope of NASA. And so from that perspective, things are better in that nobody perceives they're going to get worse. I still think most people here are awaiting something bigger. Now, be that a big government program again or a really viable commercial program, I don't know that they really care. But doing something exciting and challenging again that really pushes the limits of our creativity is what I see many people here at Marshall would like to be engaged in. And unfortunately, I think we all have to be just patient a little while longer, but I think it's coming.
Okay. Mark, I want to thank you for being back with us again. A Merry Christmas and Happy New Year to you, and I'm sure we'll be talking to you down the road in 2013 as well.
Same to you, and thanks again for having me.
Okay, and listeners, that's it for today with Mark Bray. And tomorrow evening, Heather, the Pillow Knot astronaut, you can read about her in our websites, in our newsletters, I mean, is going to talk to us about the NASA, bed rest studies. And so that's going to be real interesting to talk about these programs. So don't want to miss tomorrow night, 7 p.m. California time. Thanks for Mark Bray and all of you for participating. Goodbye from the space shuttle.